Thank you for listening to this talk, produced by the Art Gallery of South Australia.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us for our... Oh, yes, it's very boomy now. Hello, Angela. It's a lovely small group. And I'm so impressed that anyone is here, to be honest, because what a day it is out there after many of them. So a big thanks for you to you all for making it out on such a hot day, particularly some of our intrepid regulars. Well done. My name's Lisa Slade and I am here on Gana Yerda. Nyadlu Tampandi, Nyadlu Garana Mianaya Tanga Yuandi. And as I always say in translating what I've just said in Garana, it's so important to acknowledge that we meet here today on the lands of the Kaurna people. I'm going to talk a little bit about place, not so locally, but I am going to talk about place today. And my talk for the next half hour or so is going to be folk, and I'm happy to take questions, as many of you would know. My talk for this Tuesday talk, which is being recorded and will be available as part of our podcast series on SoundCloud, my talk is going to focus on a rather belated opportunity to celebrate and to look at International Women's Day. International Women's Day, of course, is on the 8th of March and it was last Friday. We didn't do a talk on Friday, so we're doing a talk on Tuesday, and I thought it would give us a great opportunity to focus in on, I'm going to talk about four of the women artists who are in Inner Sanctum in this exhibition. And I'd love it to be as discursive as possible. These works are still very fresh for me. This exhibition opened, is it 2 weeks ago now, Jay? Two and a bit, maybe. So they're still very, very fresh for the Art Gallery of South Australia. They are, of course, part of the 18th Adelaide Biennial of Australian Art called Inner Sanctum. There are some clues there in that title about what's happening in this biennial. And, of course, the biennial has been curated by Jose da Silva. His day job is as director of the University of New South Wales Galleries, just in Oxford Street there, as part of the University of New South Wales campus, and he worked very closely with us and, of course, with 24 artists from across the country to present this exhibition, which opened a couple of weeks back. I am going to look at the idea of something that Griselda Pollock wrote about. Griselda Pollock is a feminist art historian, a really important thinker in the story of rewriting and reviewing art histories. I had the great honour of meeting her probably about 15 years ago now when she was at Leeds University in the UK. She wrote a text which talks about differencing the canon, and she uses the word canon to refer, canon with one N, to refer to the art historical canon. Canon's often a word that's used to relate to the religious canon, and in that sense it refers to a set of accepted, dominant, mainstream beliefs, ideas and histories. She, Griselda Pollock, Professor Pollock, spoke about this idea that our job as feminist art historians is to difference the canon. So I'm going to take my cue from Pollock to talk about the work of three artists in this space and then end briefly on a discussion of the work of Teela George just out here. As mentioned, I want it to be a conversation and I'm happy to take interjections with such a lovely intimate group. I'm happy to take interjections as we go. I'd like to kick off with the work of Marikit Santiago, and there are two works here by Marikit Santiago. The work on the left-hand side of the southern end is a work that's held in the collection of the Art Gallery of New South Wales, and the work on the right side is a work that was made for this exhibition and as yet does not have a home. That makes it sound a little bit bereft. I don't mean it like that. It's just that it hasn't been acquired as yet because it's a brand new work. As I like to say, it's a work that when it arrived in the gallery, it was probably still wet. And therein lies one of the great, very exciting aspects of the Adelaide Biennial, in that work is made for you, importantly. It is made for its audiences. Marikit Santiago is a Filipino-Australian artist. She was born here in Australia, but was born into a Filipino family in Melbourne initially, and she now lives in Western Sydney. She lives just outside of Parramatta. And Marrakit talks about kind of being born, and I'm sure those of you who have a cultural heritage which is other than Anglo or other than First Nations can attest to this, feeling as though she was kind of born in two places, here in Australia, but within a deeply Filipino cultural context. Her work references that context. Now, has anyone been to the Philippines? The Philippines is an extraordinary cultural intersection of the impact of Catholicism specifically, but then, of course, also Tagalog ancestral beliefs. Those two things are brought to bear in the work of Marrakit Santiago. Those two things are brought to bear within a broader context or framework of an artist who, without exception, paints herself and her family in her works. She does more than paint herself and her family. She actually works in collaboration with herself and her family. Let me go back to Griselda Pollock for a minute, Indifferencing the Canon. What Marrakit Santiago is doing is interesting within a feminist art historiography framework, because she is, as a Filipino artist of both Catholic and animist ancestry, living in Australia, she's drawing upon those intersections, but moreover, she is making art collaboratively. Griselda Pollock would tell us that the canon of Western art history is based on the notion of a sole progenitor of art. And I'm sure you all know what the gender of that progenitor would be. The whole idea that an artist is almost by cultural definition, clearly I'm not prescribing to this idea, but she would say that art history, the art historical canon, is made up of singular male artists in succession across time. Here we have a collaborative practice that involves herself, her family, her cultural heritage, and the intercultural influences in that cultural heritage. You might be sitting in front of me thinking, she's using a lot of words. What I'm going to do now is look at the painting to help you out with some of those words that I'm throwing around with abandon. This, of course, is Marrakit herself. This is her husband, Sean. And these are her three children. If you're around over the opening weekend of Inner Sanctum, you will have met Sean and the three children and of course, Marrakit. Marrakit talks about the collaboration being not just about her representation of her family. Let's face it, women artists have often used their own families because they were subjects close to hand. If we think about the famous Elizabeth Vigée Lebrun, for instance, or Paula Modis Ombeka, they often painted themselves and their families because they were straightforward subjects, readily available subjects. Here we have, and let's say, a reading and a rereading of herself and her family that blends the influences that I've spoken to. When you look closely, you realise that this painting is actually painted not on canvas, linen or board, but on cardboard. It's painted on cardboard. This is no accident. Rarely is it for artists to choose this type of materiality. This is a materiality which has a kind of propensity to break down. That's why it's so useful, cardboard as a carrier. For Marrakit Santiago, she says that the materiality is critical to this notion of a migratory practice, critical to this notion of change and impermanence. She flattens, not only does she use cardboard, but it's as though she's flattening out cardboard boxes to paint on those boxes as canvases. Cardboard also allows her to include drawing in a way that perhaps painting on board or linen may not. That drawing is both her own and the drawing of her children. When you get a chance after I've stopped speaking to come and have a close look at this painting, you'll notice that there are drawn creatures, is the word I want to use, because they're a blend of the mythic, the imaginary and the real. Drawn creatures populate the surface of this work. Drawn creatures by her children. She's co-opted them as collaborators. Marrakit has added some of her own creatures, but she's done so using a tool like a soldering iron so that she could burn into the card, once again, into the cardboard, once again a process that cloth, canvas, linen or board board may allow it, but certainly not linen or cloth as your backing board, backing surface. This pyrography, this drawing with fire, starts from the edge of the work and moves across as though it's a kind of reptile-like reference, direct references, in fact, to the crocodile as it starts to snake or make its way across the composition. Can everybody see that? The colour is a sepia-toned colour that starts here and makes its way across the entire surface. She is unafraid to leave aspects of the cardboard coming through. I find that particularly interesting, given that she is a fan of virtuosic, detailed painting. Often expressive, quasi-abstract artists are happy to leave parts of the cardboard coming through. It's more rare in the case of an artist who is so into the detail and of figuration. She brings together the animist stories of her pre-colonial country alongside references to Catholicism. Catholicism is probably best seen, references to religion are probably best seen in this sister work over here that belongs to the Art Gallery of New South Wales. But for her, this is a heady mix where it's very difficult to extricate one thing from another, as I think it often is in our lives. Her titles themselves often make reference to Catholic prayer, Catholic sayings. For very few of you have travelled to the Philippines, but the Philippines is a place where Catholicism has landed in a certain way, that rituals around Easter are particularly spectacular. So it's not uncommon at Easter time to experience for people to experience stigmata. So members of the public, Filipinos, would experience stigmata, the idea of blood from your hands, palms, or from your feet, in imitation of the journey of Christ. Such is the level of kind of empathetic religion, I just kind of made that term up, but you get the idea that one would will oneself into that faith. The other reason I thought it was highly appropriate to reference Marakit's work, that I'm very new to, this is the first time I've met the artist and seen her work, is that the Philippines are home to both matrilineal and this is a bit debatable, depending on which anthropologist you speak to, matriarchal societies. The difference between a matriarchy and a matriliny is simply defined as matriarchy refers to who holds the power. You've all heard the term patriarchy, matriarchy. Man holds the power, woman holds the power. Matrilineal and patrilineal, which you normally hear referred to as matrilineal or patrilineal, relates to where the power or wealth or knowledge or naming is distributed. So in the case of a matrilineal, you inherit through the female line. Matrilineal means the mother's line. Now in the case of Santiago's family, that means that names and customs come through the mother's line. Many anthropologists have made observations about Filipino society that it's inherently matrifocal is the word you'll hear used, which you can kind of work out what all these words mean. That is that women take responsibility for the day-to-day commercial and domestic aspects of a family life. Women are not, you'll hear stories in the West of women 100 years ago not having access to the family purse. In Filipino culture, and I say that knowing that the Philippines is, of course, an archipelago, and there are very strong differences between one island and another to do with these patterns of colonization and influence and the impact of Tagalog ancestral belief. But in Filipino culture, it is not uncommon for women to hold that strong social and domestic role. So strong that quite recently, Marakit Santiago changed her children's family name. They now carry her name. So the children are now Santiago's, and that was a decision supported by her husband. I think it's really easy for us, particularly living in Australia, with such a dominant kind of invader story, I suppose, to sometimes think of Western culture as being kind of the dominant or singular way of thinking. But for Marrakech Santiago, as I mentioned before, living in Western Sydney, a place that I used to reside in, so I know it very well, in a place of incredible cultural diversity, she lives within that cultural framework of a Filipino matriliny in her direct life. Does that make sense? I think all that's brought to bear in the work. She validates and makes work about her family context. She makes work about her children. She doesn't do it in a sort of soppy, apologetic way. She collaborates with her children. She mentioned in the opening weekend that she requires of her children that they attend her talks. So they're not silent muses. They're not there just to kind of, you know, for last minute inspiration. They're there because they are agents within this storytelling for her. I'm being very kind of Northern Pacific Polynesian in my orientation today, Southeast Asian, Pacifica, across that area. And I'm going to leap from Marrakech Santiago down here to the work of Ruha Fafita. Don't feel like you need to stay seated. If you want to come and encircle this work, you are more than welcome to. Do as you wish. This is a Nyatu. Nyatu is spelt N-G-A-T-U. And just as Marrakech Santiago is new to me, as is Ruha Fafita. It's one of the really exciting things when we get to play host here at the Art Gallery to biennials curated by outside curators. You're introduced to a whole new lot of talent. And Ruha Fafita is a very good example. This is a practice not exclusively, this is a way of working, not exclusively practiced by women, but held by women. This is a matrifocal practice. Differencing the canon, back to Griselda Pollock. Pollock's canon of pre-feminist art did not include practices that were held by women, practices that were kept, maintained, shared and held by women. In this instance, we have a 8 to 10 metre. I could step it out, but I won't distract you all with my inelegant steps. Nyatu, which has been made predominantly with Ruha at the helm, but with her family involved. Once again, that's a classic example of differencing the canon, the idea that you're not sure where someone's work begins and another finishes. Ironically enough, though, the Western canon of painting is actually mostly established upon the notion of collaboration. It just wasn't acknowledged. Linda. Sure. Thank you, Linda. Linda wants to know more about the pattern, which we will definitely get to. This work is made, it's described as a bark cloth. And I'm more familiar with, as many of you would probably be, more familiar with the tapa cloths that come from other parts of Polynesia in particular. Not dissimilar in practice or process at all. Nyatu is made generally from mulberry bark. I have a mulberry tree in my backyard, so I was very excited to hear this. Mulberry bark in particular. So it's a soft bark, almost like a paper bark, actually, if you think about the way an Australian paper bark appears. Not that mulberries necessarily look like that. It's treated so that it creates a softness. So it's pulped so you get that kind of softness and then it's layered and woven. Now, the patination, all of which is applied with natural pigments, is actually referencing two things simultaneously. One are the bindings that are used in Tongan architecture, the bindings that bring together the poles of the house or the dwelling, let's call it a dwelling because that's more in keeping with the idea of inner sanctuary. In that dwelling, the wrappings from one part to another keep the structure strong. You can see already the metaphoric possibilities of those bindings, of keeping culture strong, keeping a family together, the idea of keeping everybody kind of close and strong together through these bindings. The more rosette-like forms relate to two things. And once again, new to me, so I don't have every answer at all. We will have, if we don't already, the conversations from the opening weekend up online. You can listen to as a SoundCloud. They're not there yet, are they, Jay? But they'll be up in the next couple of weeks. Go and visit because you'll get a chance to listen to Ruha Fafita and Marakit talk about their work in their own words, and you can compare their notes with mine. These rosette forms relate both to her Celtic family. There are a couple of references on the wall text that you can have a look at, but they also relate to her Baha'i faith. Baha'i religion has been very influential in Tonga. It's a very strong religion, introduced religion in Tonga. I don't know a lot about the Baha'i faith, but I do know that in terms of design and architecture, these forms are often present in Baha'i design. So these things all come together. This matrilineal, matrifocal aspect means that this work at the moment is, it's kind of relatively dormant. It's alive. Ruha would say this work is alive, but it would be more alive if she and her sisters were sitting on it. That would be its kind of natural context. It would be more alive if it was used to sleep with or sleep under. So the context of Nyatu is that it is a link, it is a bridge, it is a connection between people, between families. It's a way of people manifesting their identity, staying connected with each other. This work, just like Marakit's painting here, was made for the Adelaide Biennial. So it's being seen for the very first time. With that comes layers of excitement and experimentation. The making of this plinth, for instance, a shout out to our workshop team, was made in advance of the Nyatu arriving. It arrived rolled up. People look at it and think, wow, it was actually relatively easy. Very, very, very light. And it arrived, it's quite robust as well, more robust than regular paper, for instance. It arrived rolled up. We had a precarious moment of making sure that it managed to fit on the plinth. And you'll notice in truer version of geometry, it doesn't quite fit on the plinth in some parts. It does this kind of delicious overhang, none of which the artist was in the slightest bit concerned about. When she arrived, the first thing she did was step into or sit into the work. She updated the colours, so she got some water to spread some of the colours. This work, in a way, is the touchstone for the theme of this part of the biennial, which is the river path. And Jose, from the very beginning of his ideas 18 months ago, described this work as being the kind of anchor to this room. And I think you'll agree with me that it succeeds in being that visual anchor. So this matrilineal focus continues through the work. These stories are held by women, they're shared by women, they're manifest by women. Seeing a painting made collaboratively on cardboard, a painting made collaboratively to be viewed in this kind of prone position, to me underscores this differencing of the canon and invites our differencing of the canon. I'd argue that we're a little bit immune to perhaps some of the ideas that Griselda Pollock was challenged with in the 1970s because we've had half a century of women artists differencing the canon. So that this may not seem radical or revolutionary to you. I'm just giving you some kind of art historical context. One of the things that I find really interesting about this work, we haven't shown a lot of tapa or a lot of Nyatu in South Australia. That's because we're a fair way, say compared to Queensland, we're a fair way from the Northern Islands, we're a fair way from Melanesia, Micronesia and Polynesia. This work though could be displayed in different ways. It could, for instance, turn and drape over that entire wall, cascade down that wall like a waterfall. It could be rolled and part of it revealed. It could be shown in a lot of different ways. That in itself, I think, is a good example of the contemporary art differencing of the canon that's happened, that we don't think about a work like this as being shown in one modality only. The third artist I want to introduce you to is Kay Brown, and it's Kay's work that is at the southern end of these galleries here. Please make sure you pick up one of these from the plinth at the southern end before you leave today. Kay's work, as many of you would know, is not on the fulsome display that we anticipated because in an absolute misadventure that I've never seen the scale of in my work years in working, decades of working in museums, the work that was coming to Adelaide was lost in a fire. It was lost in a truck fire. Now, I'm sharing that with you because Kay wants us to share that with you, but also because I don't think the storytelling belongs to me as the curator, well, a curator. It belongs to her as the artist. And for Tiwi, there is a death or a mourning ceremony called Pukamani. And I would argue that Tiwi, in differencing the canon, are extraordinarily well placed to deal with, consider, and ritualise loss. Part of what's displayed here is the ritualisation of loss that has been led by the artist. For Tiwi, the matrilineal, the story through the mother's line, is really important. There are four skin names or skin classifications in the Tiwi Islands. Those of you who've heard that term before will know that a skin name is part of a kinship structure. It's a way of keeping culture safe and keeping culture intact because it means that you don't marry across bloodline. Well, you marry to the right people, if you see what I mean, in small communities. They are matrilineal, those kinship names, those skin names. So once again, through the mother's line, these are things that art historians haven't liked to focus on. Through the mother's line, you find out your identity, your social and cultural identity. In the case of the Tiwi, you have the overlay of that kinship structure with the ritualisation of loss and mourning, which involves a thing called puata. Puata is spelt P-W-A-J-O. P-W-O-J-A, spelt nothing like you say it, importantly. And puata relates to the patterning that you would place on the face and the body, but it's also the word that's used to refer to the comb that does that patterning. Everything will make sense when you pick up one of these brochures because you will see the wonderful Kay Brown in the photograph wearing the puata on her face. The puata, which is traditionally, I believe, shells and other things were used to pattern the face. I've seen more recently, and in many of the last probably century or so, hardwood combs made from ironwood. They're like a little short tooth comb that is rocked across ochre and then applied to the face and to the body. Now, all Tiwi will know this puata. They will know it in the context of what's called jilamara. And jilamara is the design that's used in ceremony and in performative cultural play, something called yoi. Yoi. For Kay Brown, her art making is an extension of that practice. Her art making is understood directly in the context of yoi and puata. Rather than using a brush or even a reed to make her marks in ochre, she uses this puata. On the right-hand side, and I apologise for how far we are from them, but you'll have time in a minute to go and have a look, there are two barks made by Kay Brown. Kay Brown is a senior woman. She has spent most of her life as an educator in Millicuppity in the Tiwi Islands. She has only more recently started exhibiting her work. It's only really been in the last 5 to 7 years that she would have considered herself to be an artist. Having said that, I want to kind of reiterate the term that Ruha says, there's no word for art in Tongan language. I would similarly say for many Aboriginal language, there is no word for art per se. This idea that it's something that's kind of sanctioned and kind of quarantined off from everything else is an odd Western idea that I think doesn't even hold water for us, to be honest. So these barks over here attest to decades, a life of cultural practice that's found its new place of resting, if you like, of articulation is probably a better word, a new place of articulation on the body of a bark. I want you to think about barks differently from this moment on. Bark, that it's used for bark painting, not the mulberry that's used here for Nyatu, is from the Eucalyptus tetradonta, or the stringy bark tree. And they're the eucalypts that grow in massive numbers across the whole of northern Australia. That bark is harvested only in the wet season because you can't get it off the tree in the dry season. In the wet season, because of the amount of water that runs through along the tree, it pops off the tree. It's flattened and smoked and rested for about a year before it's painted. That bark is like a physical body. It's clearly the body of the tree, but it has a kind of life force. And I reckon even from where you're sitting, you can see the life force in those barks because they're curling into the shape of the tree. Can you see that? They're curling back into, they have a kind of arboreal memory is what I would call it. They remember themselves as trees. And if you've had barks at home, particularly outside of a climate that's controlled like this one, you'll know that they return to their bodies as barks. That bark body is important. I'm not just giving you the conservator's tip. It's important because there's a direct relationship between the human body and then the body of the tree and the way all of those things are celebrated and marked through the ceremony of Pukamani. During the death ritual, the death mourning ritual, Pukamani happens and it is represented probably most beautifully through the tutini. And if you look down to the south now, you'll see a sculpture with a basket made of bark on the top of the sculpture. That's an example of the tutini. That tutini is also marked, its body is marked with the same rocking ochre made by a porta as the bark paintings over on this western wall. The basket that's placed at the top may be new to you. You don't always see tutini with tunga, what are known as tunga, on the top. The tunga represents life, all the things contained in one's life. And in this instance, that basket is upturned at the end of one's life and placed on the tutini. Tutini are placed into the landscape and are returned to earth. Their colours are not repainted. They're marked, as you can see there, with white, yellow, red and black. The white is the purest ochre and as a result, the most highly prized. It's harder to find. Places in the top end of Australia that have white ochre are considered to be sacred places. The Gunungu artist John Mawanjul talks about white ochre as the feces of the rainbow serpent. So I had a joke with him and I said, so it's holy shit. And he said, yeah, it's holy shit. So the yellow is found in the ground, and when the yellow ochre is heated, it turns into various colours of the orange and the red. So artists are very good at knowing how far to heat the yellow to make it orange, red in those colours. And then, of course, the black is charcoal. So the full tiwi palette is represented in these works by Kay. Now, you can imagine the kind of thinking that had to be done, the cultural thinking, the deep thinking, but more importantly, the listening that had to be done when the barks were lost and the tutini. There were tutini as well as barks that were lost in the truck fire. The project that you see here has come about not overnight. I'm sure most of you realise that most of these projects are realised over a 2-year period, but also informed by years, sometimes decades. For Kay, decades. My favourite answer to the question, which everyone loves to ask about Aboriginal art, people love to say to me, how long did that take? And my favourite answer is 80,000 years. Because such is the depth of kind of cultural knowledge that people are drawing upon that ancestral knowledge, even if they're making the work in a relatively short window. Now, when we kind of got to the moment of thinking, Kay, how do you wish to best present yourself in the biennial? She said, could you please see if the work of my ancestors can be awoken for this show? Can you wake up those barks and bring them in here? And what she was talking about are the three barks from Goose Creek, which is where she's from. That's Goose Creek, you can see on the video there. Those three barks from Goose Creek were collected by C.P. Mountford, who would need little introduction to many of you, I imagine. Charles Percy Mountford, there's a plaque on North Terrace to him. He lived across the way in Hackney, and he was on the Aziel expedition, which is the American and Australian expedition into Arnhem Land that happened in 1948. He lived in Adelaide for most of his life and was a passionate advocate of the role of Aboriginal culture as art. He's kind of responsible for saying to art gallery directors at the time, I'm not going to give everything to museums only, they're going to come to you as well. So some of our earliest collections have come via Mountford. Mountford commissioned work, so he would say to artists, can you paint me the story of your culture, as well as collecting work that already existed from 1948 on. The three barks in that cabinet are from the, they're probably made in the 40s, but they were acquired by the museum next door in about 1953 or 54 from memory. They are the barks made by Kay's ancestors. At the moment, they do not carry the names of those ancestors, and many of you would be familiar why. With why. It's not that we didn't know the names of those artists, is that the idea of an Aboriginal artist having a name was not deemed to be of cultural importance. That works were acquired as evidence of broad brushstroke evidence of culture as indicative, not specific. Does that make sense? In fact, and this is where I'm glad that I live on this side of the fence and not that side, most of the museum's collections are marked by the names of the anthropologists who collected them, not by the people who made the works. Mountford collection is a case in point. We're hoping, with Kay's help, that we can attribute those works for the museum and that they might be able to go home with the name of their makers. That would be good, wouldn't it? These three barks attest to the extraordinary talent and diversity of mark-making practices 75 years ago. Tiwi have had a long tradition of men and women making art. One of the fortunate things about not having a word for art is that you don't get to have a word for artists, which means you don't get to gender the idea of who does it and who doesn't do it. So Kay Brown, as a keeper of knowledge, she has been, I feel like she's been working towards this moment for a very long time, which may underscore a kind of Western sense of tragedy or loss. But I want to read you Kay's words about her experience of this project. And think about some questions that you might have for me, by the way. Yirinkiri Porta is the name of the body of work. The word Porta is at the end of the word. Yirinkiri Porta. Yirinkiri Porta was not just a significant collection of new work by Kay Brown. This is written by the Art Centre manager, Will Heathcote. It was the coming together of an important Tiwi family group to collectively celebrate cultural heritage through the process of making. It is not the work of one artist in isolation or one exhibition, and in this way, it was not wholly lost, but lives on in the story of its making. In the words of the Goose Creek family, this is the coming together of old and new. This is our story. Kay and her family travel down for the opening, and Kay very rightly says, this is just part of the process. All is not lost, far from it. This is all part of this extraordinary cycle that continues. I feel like I would like my very final words. I'm just about over time. I probably am over time, really. Jay, don't you think? 3 minutes more. I'm going to finish with Teela George because that's how you'll exit. And Teela's work is not only in what we call Gallery 7, which is around the top of the stairs, but also in Gallery 3, which is the older wing. And I'd encourage you to go and see the work there. I love Teela's work because it's a nice place to end a discussion around the kind of canonical or this idea of a Western history canon. She decides to reinvigorate or reinvent painting, not as a mark made with a viscous material, but as a stitch across time and a stitch, a timelessness in each of those stitches. She decides to use an improbable material, one connected very much with the canon of Western history, that is bronze, the thing that's reserved for the monuments of men in her practice. That bronze is made malleable by her hands. Her casting process means that she decides to leave the trace of her body and herself in the material before it's cast. She talks about the cloth or the stitch as having a patina, that the colours that she uses refer, of course, to the sky. All of her titles are indebted to the sky, but also to the patina of bronze and to the shifting of bronze when it oxidizes. So she brings the stitch together with this idea of the thread or textile together with the bronze to create these kind of anti-monuments. Some of them are monumental in scale, monumental endeavors to install them. The work on the Northern Wall weighs about 150 kilos. They are, of course, works that in the story of the Western canon would have been overlooked because the thread cloth textiles were believed not to belong to the public masculine space, but to the private feminine one. I'm just so thrilled that within a few metres, José da Silva as curator has differenced the canon so radically. I think Griselda Pollock would love the show, that we have these textile monuments that quote from art history, the wonderful, wonderful matrilineal visions of, well, all three artists in many ways. So Ruja Fafita, Marikit Santiago, Ruja Fafita, and of course Kay Brown. Thank you very much. Have a gorgeous rest of your day. Thank you.